Welcome to Rogue Cell Radio, where story meets service. I'm Brad, producer and co-director, joined as always by our host, Sean. Today, I'll be stepping into the lead role for this interview. Our guest shares a much more advanced, but similar background and a mental health diagnosis that closely mirrors my own. And that connection felt important to honor firsthand. Our guest, Major General Greg F. Martin, PhD, retired, is a combat-tested engineer, strategist, and former senior leader in the U.S. Army. With over 36 years of service, he commanded in Iraq, earned a PhD from MIT, and led institutions like the National Defense University and the Army War College. But his most profound mission began after retirement, when he publicly shared his diagnosis of bipolar disorder, a condition that shaped his leadership and nearly cost him everything. His memoir, Bipolar General, is a courageous account of mental illness, recovery, and the urgent need to break stigma, especially among leaders entrusted with the lives of others. General Martin, I want to start by saying thank you.
Thank you, Brad. I really appreciate it. And thanks for your leadership and Sean's leadership in this super important field. You know, I had this incredibly challenging experience with mental illness that essentially ended my Army career, forced me to retire. I mean, I got fired from my job and then was hospitalized. And then having come through it in one piece, still alive, still with a family, I decided that my life mission and purpose would be sharing this story so that other people could benefit from my experience and lessons learned and hopefully make a difference in the lives of, you know, veterans as well as the general population.
That's fantastic. So I listened to your book while I was traveling, and it hit me hard because, like you, I was an Army engineer officer, my career much shorter than yours. And I was only a major when I was retired. But when I was diagnosed with a mental health diagnosis of schizoaffective disorder, my medical evaluation board began, and it took about 18 months. But a big moment for me was when I figured out something was wrong with me. When you first started to realize something was wrong, whether in hindsight or in the moment, what did you feel like emotionally?
Well, it turns out I've actually lived on the bipolar spectrum my entire life, and It really helped me by giving me lots of extra energy, drive, creativity, and so forth. But then things changed in the Iraq War, according to The investigation of the VA and the Army Medical Department, because they, after I got diagnosed in 2014 as a 58-year-old two-star, both The Army and the VA said, how did this two-star general come down with bipolar disorder? And they both came to the conclusion that my genetic predisposition for bipolar disorder was triggered during the Iraq War, that it was the stress, the thrill, the pressure, all of that stuff that went with combat, that triggered the underlying condition. I realized there's something wrong when I got back to Germany from Iraq. We had deployed out of Germany, spent a year in Iraq. I was mostly manic, performed really well, had tons of energy. But when I got home, I sunk into depression. Mm-hmm. No energy, no interest, secluded, isolated, confused, indecisive. So during our redeployment health screening, I told the doctor, I said, hey, there's something wrong with me. I'm usually extroverted, full of energy. My mind is really sharp, very decisive, really quick mentally. I'm just the opposite. Something's wrong. What's going on? So they evaluated me for depression, but they were blinded by my success. So All they could see was a guy, super successful, high ranking, all this talent, and they couldn't see that I was in the depressive phase of bipolar disorder. So they said, you're fine, you're fit for duty. Pretty much just suck it up, deal with it, drive on. And so I said, you know, okay. Mm-hmm. Well, about a year later, I still had the depression. I went to the doctor again and said, there's something wrong with me. Same story. They said, you're fine. But I wasn't fine. It was only on the seventh evaluation when my wife went to the appointment, and her comments caused the lights to go on for the doctors, where they connected the dots and they said, okay, he's depressed now, before he was manic. Okay, that sounds and looks and feels like bipolar disorder.
I also am at Iraq, where I can look backwards now and see a triggering event for me. But in that time since, I'm guessing it was about 12 years as well until I was started on my medical board, or until it finished. So mine was a little quicker, flash to boom, 10 years then. Another similarity that really strikes me is that my wife and I were sitting on our front porch on Halloween one year, having our morning cup of coffee before I went into work. And she said, I want you to go into mental health today. Later that day, I found myself in an intensive inpatient program because apparently I told them I was suicidal. I don't even remember that conversation, but
I did have a question first. Like, what job did you have while you're doing this? But also, what did people see that made them concerned about what you were doing?
So the different jobs that I had were, you know, in Iraq. And when I got home from Iraq and went to the doctor voluntarily for the first time, I was a brigade commander of a combat engineer brigade. The second time I went to the doctor on my own, I was the deputy operations officer for U.S. Army Europe, which is a 4-star headquarters. So big job. The third time I went in for help on my own, I, again, in a depression, I was the commandant of the Army War College. And then the time that I got ordered by my boss, the day he fired me, he ordered me to go in and get help. I was the president of National Defense University in Washington, D.C. And then the seventh try, when I went in voluntarily and I was diagnosed, I was in kind of the Army was pretty good to me. After I got fired from the joint staff, they put me in kind of a soft landing job. It was an Army job with the Corps of Engineers. Now, what did people actually see? When I was president of NDU, they started seeing grandiosity, where I actually thought I was the smartest person in the world, that I had this grand strategic plan to develop world peace. And I talked about it in terms of what the university, not National Defense University, could do to better prepare its leaders and play a role in forming and developing, you know, peace throughout the world. And then my aggressiveness and impulsivity in putting this strategy into place. Then things that go with mania, I started talking faster and faster, started talking more and more and more. I've since found out that there were periods where I would talk for 2 hours, 4 hours, reportedly one time, 8 straight hours, without saying, you know, giving people a chance to talk or ask questions. I started getting more and more hyper-religious, which is called religiosity. So, I mean, I was doing, personally, that's fine to be religious on your own. And I was doing, you know, prayer breakfast, Bible studies, discipleship training, going to about 4 different churches, doing things at night, on the weekend, I was with a group that we did street evangelization. And then I brought it into the workplace, where I really made a point out of, you know, God, when people would challenge my transformation plans, I would say, hey, God has picked me out as his, you know, disciple or apostle to come into National Defense University and lead change to bring about world peace, explaining and telling people how I was God's chosen apostle, you know, that kind of alarmed people. I was off the cuff, you know, pretty much out of control, very, very impulsive. I would go into classrooms and lecture halls. I would just like show up unscheduled, interrupt the professor or the lecture, and just take over and start talking about my vision for change and that sort of thing. You know, and this went on and on. I used to go out on, you know, midnight, 1, 2, 3 in the morning bike rides around Washington, D.C. And people didn't see it, but I hallucinated that I would lift up on my bike and be flying over the city, you know, over and around and between the monuments. And so this went on for a few months. And then people were really concerned about my health. And they were concerned about the university, that I was an erratic, impulsive, out of control leader with tremendous energy and authority and forcefulness, that it really scared them. My behavior started to frighten them. So, you know, it's very difficult for subordinates to come in and talk to a two-star general, the commander, and say, hey, are you okay? Is your mental health okay? I recommend you go see a doctor. So they did what thing they saw that was feasible for them. They started writing letters to my boss, again, four-star general, chairman of the Joint Chiefs. And so he got dozens of these letters from students, faculty, administrators at the university saying, there's something wrong with General Martin. He is out of control. He's off the rails. He's over the edge.
It sounds like to me that all of the problems that you were struggling with also made you a good leader. These problems that you're having also are strengths. And it's like a two-edged sword there.
You hit the nail on the head. You know, the bipolar disorder helped me enormously for my entire career with the extra energy, drive, creativity, problem-solving skills. My mind was like a computer. Like when I went to MIT, the Army gave me the mission to get one master's degree, and I came out with two master's degrees and a PhD. Now, that is not normal human behavior. So your point is really well said.
I want to shift a little bit and talk about some of the stigmas inside of the military and outside the military as well for mental health. And want to specifically ask about, what would you say to a commander who suspects that there is something amiss in his own head or in one of his soldiers?
Thankfully, I mean, the Army and the military have pushed a lot of the mental health support down to a much lower level. So you've got mental health professionals down that are easily accessible to the troops that are, you know, in a tactical unit or on a ship or on the flight line or that kind of thing. And so I would say, look, we're going to set up an appointment for you with the therapist or the social worker. It maybe doesn't even need to be a psychiatrist, but just some kind of person who's got expertise in this field. And, you know, there's no harm, no foul. We want you to get over and see them. You're going to be much better off getting help and treatment, because with a mental health condition, if you don't get treatment, there's a good chance you're going to lose your career because everything's going to fall apart, lose your marriage, your family, lose your finances. There's a good chance you're going to end up addicted to alcohol or drugs, could end up homeless, could end up in jail, could end up killed or death by suicide. And then I'd say, stay engaged, keep in touch, and you know, monitor the situation with the first line supervisor and keep an eye on things to, you know, make sure the person's okay.
If you're just joining us, this is Rogue Cell Radio with Sean Davis and Brad Peitzig. Today we're interviewing General Greg F. Martin, author of Bipolar General: My Forever War with Mental Illness.
Brad was talking about the stigma of mental health issues in the military. You were in for, you said, was it 36 years?
Yes.
How has that stigma changed over your career in the military?
When I first came in the 70s, you know, nobody talked about mental illness. Mm-hmm. Nobody talked about mental health. There was no access available at all to the troops. There was zero talk, zero training, nothing. And so it was just like, okay, that person, you know, lost their mind. They went crazy and they're out of the military. And then over time, the Vietnam generation, I think, taught us a lot about PTSD, where more and more Vietnam vets started coming to light with PTSD. And so we started learning about it. And then the military still had a big stigma. It's always been, hey, be strong, be tough, never admit weakness, just suck it up and be tough. And what happened is very, very interesting. When we went to war in 2001, nobody knew that we were going to be at war on this global war on terrorism for 20 years. Nobody knew that. With an all-volunteer force, that in order to do the type of rotations we were doing, you needed a much, much larger force. And that's why the military leaned so heavily on the guard and the reserves, because the active forces were too small to do these rotations. And so then people started getting PTSD and depression and all this sort of stuff. And so the military was discharging all these people for these mental health conditions. And they said, wait a second, we can't afford to discharge these people. We have to figure out how to keep them and work with them. And so they said, okay, can we work with people with PTSD, even if they have to take medication and get some therapy? And they said, yeah, we can do this. We can put some therapists and some psychiatrists down in the units. We can, you know, these pills are, you know, and there's nothing that outrageous about the behavior of someone with PTSD or depression. And if there is, we can discharge them. But if we can work with them, we could keep a lot more troops, thousands and thousands of troops in the force structure that eased the deployment schedule. And so what happened is the military went on kind of a journey, a medical research journey, figuring out how to accommodate and keep more people, and then how to prevent mental health. So talk about it more, have more training on it, have mental health professionals down in the units, you know, come to a way to understand it and deal with it preventatively as much as possible. The chief medical officer put all the medical stuff out and said, look, you know, we're going to try to accommodate you. We're going to try to work with you. We're going to try to keep you in service. It's not an automatic discharge. But if it is certain conditions, we may have to medically discharge you because your brain illness is too high for us to keep on active duty. You know, and think of it like if your knee gets so blown out, we'll have to separate you, or your back gets so broken, we have to separate you. So don't be ashamed, et cetera, et cetera. So like in the Army, it would be the squad leader, platoon sergeant level, you know.
In just coming after we came back from the war, we had a team leader who said he had PTSD and he was having a hard time with it. So they said, well, you can't carry a weapon anymore because you have homicidal tendencies. And he said, I'm in the infantry. You guys trained me to have homicidal tendencies. And so he, as a squad leader, he couldn't carry a weapon. How is he supposed to teach his team how to do anything?
Exactly. And so, you know, if you're the first or second line NCO supervisor, you're getting told you better be combat ready. You better get all this equipment up. Your troops all need to be trained, blah, blah, blah. I mean, you got to do it because that's your job. But then you're being told, hey, be empathetic and supportive of your troops who are having mental health conditions. Get them to see the therapist or the mental health provider. Don't keep them back from doing that. You know, that you do. So which way is that NCO supposed to turn? Yeah. You know, and so those first line people are being put in an impossible situation. And the head NCO for this Navy command, you know, he articulated that very clearly. And, you know, the Navy's had a big problem with suicides. From what I've seen in the military, there is a very good, solid understanding of the problem. I think people understand it well. I think there are good policies and programs and procedures that have been established, but the implementation of them, where the rubber meets the road at the tip of the spear, is hugely problematic because of the reason that I just said. And I don't see an easy way out of it. I think there's a conundrum, because the mission to train and be combat ready and deploy has got, it's so tense And then I think the nature of military service elevates mental health problems.
Oh, yeah.
I see an easy way out of this dilemma. I don't see it. I think it's a hard nut to crack, and it's not getting any easier. And I don't see a way right now to get a whole lot better with those two big competing forces. And then, of course, out of the military come all the veterans who have been in this tough environment for all these years. And then now suddenly, you know, a lot of these conditions take time to develop. I mean, like my bipolar disorder, I had it for a lifetime, and mm-hmm. it didn't explode until I had been in the military for 36 years. And, you know, now I'm in the VA system. So a lot of these things get worse over time, especially if untreated. And so now you've got this, you know, growing, bigger and bigger veteran population, and you've mm-hmm. got a force that it was in combat for 20 years in a difficult, complicated, deadly, dangerous wars. And there, so this problem is going to mushroom just like it did with the Vietnam generation. So I think the mental health problem in the veteran community is going to grow and get bigger and mm-hmm. more complex in the years to come.
Well, I asked all of our guests that if they could speak directly to a veteran that's struggling silently right now, what would you say to them?
Number one, get help. Mm-hmm. Go see a medical professional, even if it's just your, you know, your local primary care physician, but get that medical help. And then hopefully you can get evaluated and it's something you can deal with without a big, long medical process. But get help, number one, get evaluated. Because if you don't, you're heading down a path of death and destruction. But if you get medical help and get, you know, with the right people and get the right treatment, you can live a healthy, happy, purposeful life. But if you don't, and things are probably going to go bad, you're looking at death and destruction. So that would be my one big piece of advice. And then if you do get a diagnosis, embrace it. Like, you know, if you get diagnosed with some condition, say, okay, I am going to acknowledge and embrace this situation. I'm not going to deny it. I'm not going to be self-stigmatized. I'm not going to mm-hmm. be embarrassed or ashamed. I'm going to embrace it. And I'm going to learn everything I can about the condition. Learn about it, because knowledge is power. I've learned so much about bipolar disorder and mental illness to where now, you know, I've actually got universities and medical schools and research organizations that ask people like me to work with them and they call us an expert by lived experience. Mm-hmm. And so become an expert on your condition and then develop a strategy. I mean, the military is trained to think, you know, strategy, tactics, develop a plan, an operations plan on how I am going to deal with this and get better. And then develop the plan, develop the tactics, and then fight like hell. You know, get out there. Don't give up. Persevere. Stick with it. You know, have a network of people. Develop a mission and a purpose for yourself. You know, persevere. Work with your medical team, you know, your therapist, your psychiatrist. Work with your team of friends and peer support people. And remember, I can remember, you know, the really dark days of bipolar hell where I was in horrible depression, where I just every day, all I wanted to do was to die. I just thought about death and dying every day and just didn't see any hope of ever improving or getting better. And a battle buddy from the Army kind of came alongside and said, "You are going to get better. This is not a permanent condition. You can and you will get better. You have to stick with it, stick with the program, don't give up." And so this idea that you can and will get better and that there is hope, and if you can stay connected with people and take hope, you can and will get better and can build, recover and build a new life.
That's what we've been telling everybody is purpose, community, connections. I mean, that's
exactly.
Wow. Well, General Martin, I want to thank you very much for your time today. And I appreciate that you're out there fighting the good fight. And even though you're no longer in the Army, you're still out there fighting for the soldiers and fighting for everybody that's out there and fighting for yourself.
And like I said, it was just, it's really inspiring to see somebody at your level saying, you know what? It's okay to ask for help. It's okay to try to get better, acknowledge that you have issues, you know, because too many of us up there, like, you know, especially in infantry and the engineers are like, no, I'm good. I don't need that. That's for somebody else. So it's good that you're doing it. I really appreciate that.
Hey, I appreciate you too. Both your dedicated, selfless leaders working for a purpose, which I think is the most important thing in recovery and living a healthy life, is having a purpose that you have gotten your head around. You can throw yourself into serving a cause greater than self, serving others. I mean, that's what you guys are doing. And I really appreciate both of you. And if you, I know you probably have more things you want to talk about. If you want to do a follow-on, if you have more questions or things you want to talk about, or, you know, things that come to mind. I mean, it's too easy to schedule it and do a follow-up. But I just really am impressed with both of you guys. And I did want to ask Brad a quick question. Which engineer units did you serve with?
Well, I served with Charlie Company of the 84th Engineers, okay, which was out of Fort Richardson, Alaska. And, we fell into the 84th Engineer Battalion during deployments, and I went to Iraq twice with them. And then I also served with the Corps of Engineers. And then my last regular assignment before I became a mathematician in the Army was right back with the 84th Engineer Support Company Airborne out of the exact same building that I worked at before at Fort Richardson. So I was a very Alaskan engineer.
Awesome. Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
All right, guys, Brad, Sean, thank you very much. And hopefully we'll get to continue the dialogue and talk again.
Yeah, I would love that. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Yeah. I want to talk about books, because I wrote a book about my experiences in Haiti, Iraq, and New Orleans after Katrina. And I just wanted to see what you were thinking about as far as like writing some of the worst moments of your life and having to read it to strangers across the country.
That's actually one of the questions we didn't get to. I was going to mention your book and my In Progress memoir as well.
Okay.
We'll do that next time.
Yeah, that sounds good.
All right. See you later. Thanks, General.
Okay, thank you, guys. General. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of Together with Veterans Northwest Oregon or the Oregon Firearm Safety Coalition or the Department of Veterans Affairs. You can find us at roguecell.vet or facebook.com/groups/roguecell. If you or a loved one is experiencing thoughts of suicide, help is available. Please call 988 1 for veterans. This line is answered 24/7, so there is always someone to help. And with help comes hope, and hope saves lives. The second of the 503